Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Jewel by Chef Steps is a proud sponsor of Beer Sessions Radio. Jewel sous vide is the future of the kitchen. Jewel, perfect food every time. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
I'm one of HRN's interns, Nina Medvinskaya, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's topic, the marriage of food and danger. Sometimes, danger lurks in the food that we eat.
So instead of saying what is poisonous, I'd rather say what's not, because it's literally just the flesh and the fins.
Food poisoning doesn't just threaten our bodies, but it endangers our environment as well.
The emissions of JBS, combined with the other top five meat companies, exceed the annual emissions of Exxon, Shell, or BP.
For more, tune into this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, today is Tuesday, December 11th, 2018. I'm Jimmy Carboni, the host. We're here in the studios in the back of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. Wow, what a great show. I mean, it's holiday season, and we've got some of the most interesting food and beverage people in New York State here today. So let's just start. They're going to go around the room and introduce themselves, and we're going to talk some really interesting New York sourcing and some other cool New York traditions of culinary America, like beefsteak. Here we go. My hero, this is a chef that has inspired me and I've been thinking about for a long time, Mr. Waldy Maloof.
Oh, good to be here, Jimmy. Thank you for having us. I am Waldy Maloof, and I am the Senior Director of Food and Beverage for the Culinary Institute of America. I had restaurants here in the city most of my life. A few years ago, I went up to my alma mater and decided to help them build some new restaurants. As the school grew, we needed more classrooms, and so all our restaurants are classrooms as well. And we ended up building a student food hall, and within the food hall, we decided to build a 7-barrel brewery. I have a long history with Steve Hindy and Garrett Oliver at Brooklyn, where I had the Hudson River Club years ago,
and we
sort of started out together. And
that's kind of what the main direction we're going to talk about today.
Okay.
And you brought with you our buddy, Hutch.
Hey, Jimmy, how you
doing? Have a new job, don't you?
I do, yeah, thank you. I'm Hutch Kugelman. I'm the head brewer for a brewery at the CIA, where I work with Waldy, and we teach the culinary students about brewing.
Great. And quick, everyone else, we've got a couple on New York brewers and farmers and media people here as well. So, Jamie?
I'll start out. I'm Jamie Adams. I'm the owner of St. James Brewery. We're a farm brewery located on Long Island.
John?
My name is John Kinsella. I'm a farmer from Eastern Long Island in Wading River. Fourth generation, currently working the farm with my father. We have 20 acres, and we grow hops, asparagus, strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, among other things.
Great. And my good buddy from Ale Street News.
Tony Forda. Great to be back on the show, Jimmy. Ale Street News since 1992. It's been awesome to watch the evolution of food and beer over the last 25 years.
Guys, thanks for joining me. So what's special about this show is that, Waldy, I've looked up to you as a chef for a long time. And I remember it was a few years ago. Well, I heard about Brooklyn Breweries opening a brewery at the Culinary Institute of America, and it sounded amazing. And then Hutch from who had worked at Crossroads Brewery, another one of my favorite breweries in New York State, was going to be the head brewer. I was like,
What kind of job is that? That sounds amazing.
Yeah, I thought it sounded amazing too. That's kind of why I decided I should probably apply for the job. So it's great, actually. You get to work with Brooklyn Brewery. They help design and fund the brewery, help design a brand new class for our students. So we teach a class called The Art and Science of Brewing. It's for our bachelor students. And then I get to work with the CIA as well. And Brooklyn's great. They act in a really supporting role. But otherwise, the CIA, you know, really work closely with the CIA and get to work with the students. Which for me, I don't know if you know this, but before I got into brewing, now 16 years ago, as it turns out, I was a middle school teacher. So for me, teaching is kind of a natural thing.
Probably college students are easier than middle school students.
Yeah. when I say I taught seventh grade, everyone kind of goes, oh. Sorry. Everyone says sorry. Yeah. You know, one seventh grader is a wonderful kid. 30 of them are a nightmare. So, yeah, college students are great.
So they can drink and have sex, and you know,
especially
to worry
about our. I try to stay out of that part of their life, but we do taste beer responsibly in class. I like to put it that way.
Yeah. Well, Waldy, tell us this. So you went to the CIA how many years ago?
I graduated in 1975. Many years ago.
You had their great career, yeah. And everyone can look you up, so I'm not going to bet. Hudson River and
Hudson River Club,
cookbooks,
Rainbow and, Room cookbooks, yeah. And then
going back to Culinary Institute of America to be the director of the food and the beverage there, that's amazing.
Well, it was a perfect time in my life where I was restaurant free for the first time in about 30 years. And I have a good relationship with the president and the provost of the college, and they knew they were going to be building some new restaurant classrooms, and they needed some help, and they convinced me to help them, and we've actually built 5 new restaurants plus the Egg, which is where the brewery is, the food hall, and for the students, and since I've been there, and so it's been a really great, it's a great job. I get to work with students, I get to work with people like Hutch, I get to work with some great chefs, and
Let's talk more about how you put together this the brewery at the Culinary Institute and some of the things that it's doing. You know, there are classes, are students actually making beer and learning to make beer with Hutch?
Yeah,
it's a very hands-on class for sure.
I had a relationship, like I said, with Brooklyn and Garrett and Steve and Eric, and we. When this happened, we realized that, okay, we were opening a semi-professional brewery, and we needed some help with it. And we needed some guidance. And they were thrilled and excited to be part of it and make this happen. And Garrett and Steve helped us put together the design of it and worked on the curriculum with us and our instructors and Hutch and to help get us started with some recipes and some really the curriculum for the class. And then Hutch came on, and Brooklyn stays on to this day and will for many years, we hope, as a collaborator and help us. It is a CIA brewery, but Brooklyn is our sort of mentor, sponsor, and collaborator.
And it was really a natural fit. I mean, I'm sure everyone in here owns Garrett's book on food and beer pairing. It's still kind of the go-to
Brewmaster's
Table. I still have my copy dog-eared. I still flip it open when Waldy asked me to do a beer dinner, and it's some ingredient that I've never worked with before. So to go to Brooklyn, I think, was a natural thing. It's one of their big passions is pairing with food. And so they're great. They really do act in a supporting role, are there whenever our students need them, but also definitely allow us to then do our own thing. So it's all unique beers made at our restaurants and sold at our student commons.
Tony, I know you've been up to the brewery at CIA.
Yeah, a few times.
Tell us about it.
Take my daughter up there. I've been to the Egg. One of the things I noticed through Ale Street News is that Hutch has been quite active in collaborating with other brewers in New York State as well. And it's great. They all get together and make a particular brew, a lot of it, at the CIA. Right?
Yeah, well, that's where the fun is, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Who wants to make the same thing all the time? So, I mean, one or two of the same things. Yeah, you got to have some standards. But yeah, I mean, we do a lot of collaborations, both on-premise and off-premise. But yeah, it's fun. Be more creative that way, right? Take advantage of all of the great chefs that I get to work with, all the great ingredients we get to work with. You know, kind of that's one of the great things the CIA offers, is that we have this depth of knowledge that as a brewer I get to tap into.
So in terms of the program, so I'm a student. I could be, what, in my 20s? I could even be older, and I could go to Culinary Institute of America.
Absolutely. I mean, over the years, we've got our average age has gone down. So most of our students are between 18 and 24, 25, but come from I don't know, 14 different countries from around the world, but we have returning GIs and veterans and people that are 30, career changers.
But now it's like you guys are at the top of your game. So if you want to be in management or other top levels of hospitality, that's really the school
to go to. The brewery is actually, you know, part of a much larger part of the school, which is offering a more complete education to our students. Right. It's not just about being a good chef or being good in the kitchen or having good skills, although that is important. And for a lot of our students, that's what they're passionate about. But a lot of many students come to the school. Probably every student that enrolls there thinks they're either going to be on TV or they're going to own their own restaurant. And then they find out that maybe that's not what they're really passionate about. Maybe what they're passionate about is managing people, or maybe they're passionate about beverages. We have a beverage specialization where you can go you don't have to take the brewing class, but most of them do. You can go to our Napa Valley campus and learn more about wines. You can learn about spirits and mixology. We have an entrepreneurship program where the students design a restaurant concept. It's right across from where the brewery is. And they pitch these concepts to a panel of judges and chefs, and one of them wins, and they run it as a business for a semester. Everything from food costs, labor costs. Some of them do very well, and some of them fail, and I think there's lessons in that. So it's really all about providing a very comprehensive education to our students, and beer is a big part of that. As you guys all know, you know, the time when beer didn't belong on the table with wine in fine restaurants has long since passed. So it really was necessary for us to have this brewery and to offer this education and to keep expanding our offerings to our students because they're going to go out there and be the future culinary leaders of the world.
I still feel that.
And the hospitality leaders. The school has really evolved into the premier hospitality college in the world, actually. And I'd say less than 50% of our graduates actually become chefs, and more go into food and beverage research and development, entrepreneurship, management, front of the house, wine, beer. We have over 4,000 graduates. When we did the brewery, we did some research, and we have over 4,000 graduates that are involved in the beer industry or beer pubs or somehow. So there's there's a tremendous interest in it, and we just introduced a master's degree program in hospitality and restaurant management, and it's become a real very excellent college.
In terms of wine, beer, food pairings, I feel like that most chefs are comfortable with doing wine dinners, wine pairings. I've noticed from my experience that not too many chefs are really up to doing beer pairings, or maybe the quality of some of the food being made in those situations isn't what you'd expect from a good restaurant. I've also seen it happening in cider pairings as well, where a lot of chefs, I don't feel like, have been exposed to that or are comfortable with it. What are you guys doing about, food and beverage pairing, especially with the brewery at CIA?
Well, Hutch and I have been doing a couple beer dinners a year, usually at an American Bounty restaurant, which is sort of our farm-to-table restaurant at the school. We have four restaurants at the school. But we actually do the ultimate beer pairing once a year, and we call it the beefsteak, and that's every February. And I used to do them here in the city at Beacon, the restaurant I had, and I was fortunate enough to convince the powers to be to bring it up to the school. And we put 300 people in a big Farkson Hall that used to be the chapel when the college was a Jesuit seminary years ago, so it's a great room for it. And the idea, the beefsteak came about around the turn of the century, the 1820s, when it was sort of an underground type of thing where. And it was only men, and you ate beef and you drank beer, usually in the basement of a butcher shop, and
maybe some oysters to start with.
Some oysters, definitely.
Yeah, sing some songs.
I've added a few things, and there's singing, and there's a lot of beer drinking, and it's all around roasting large chunks of beef and eating as much. I explain it to people: whoever eats the most beef and drinks the most beer wins. I don't know what they win, but they win something.
It's a moral victory.
Yeah. And we do it. every Saturday, every year. This will be our sixth one this year.
What's the exact date? Because this sounds really cool.
February 2nd.
Yeah. It's February 2. It's always a Saturday before the Super Bowl.
So Hyde Park, New York. That's Hyde the Hudson Park, Valley.
York. Yep.
I love the beefsteak. Just say, yeah. It's funny. If a number of years ago, a friend of mine brought up the beefsteak, and for a couple of years, I hosted in New York. Something not quite what a beefsteak was. We called it modern beefsteak.
Yeah.
Just because we had beef. But apparently in the old days, so the, you guys sent me an article, Joseph Mitchell, who was right, a Joseph New Yorker Mitchell. Writer, 1939, he was kind of looking back at the old beefsteaks, talking about they were a male-only affair.
Yeah.
There weren't even silverware.
No silverware.
And there weren't salads either.
And we followed that rule. We let you have silverware if you want, but we try to embarrass you if you use it. But and we do enjoy women being at it, and they have a great time as well.
Do you have seats?
We do have seats, but they're communal tables. They're 20 people that don't know each other. It's a little awkward at first, but after a few beers,
a couple steins of beer, you usually get over it. Waldy mentioned this. The school was actually before the CIA bought it, was a Jesuit seminary. So there's this beautiful old chapel, which now has become Farquharson Hall. So we have this huge, basically, beer hall. So yeah. Big, long tables. You know, you arrive at the beefsteak, and you get your apron, which you're going to need, and you get your hat, and there's big blocks of cheddar with a knife in them, all this beautiful food that you really shouldn't touch, because there's going to be a hell of a lot more good food that you really want to have. But yeah, you get a big mug, and every year I brew a beer for it. You know, at this event, the food is really the star. So we want a beer that is, you know, tasty, but stays out of the way a little bit. So we do a nice Kolsch, which we call Beefsteak Blonde in honor of the event.
Quaffable.
That's the only beer available at the thing. And it's, we have servers come around with pitchers and just keep refilling your pitcher, your mug as long as you want. And
wow. Sounds
well,
like
actually,
fun.
We don't even ask.
You have to put it away if you don't want more beer.
Tell the servers, if it's half full, fill it. Keep it full. Just keep it full.
But then there's got to be, I don't know, is there six courses of food? And then
at least.
Then you get to the beef at the, you know, the show comes in, the beef gets paraded in and carved in front
Tony,
of you.
Tell me we're going to go, right? You and me.
Yeah, absolutely. Carnivore's delight.
Everyone should go. It's a blast.
Jamie and John, do you guys any traditions out on Long Island like that? Of any types of like, you know,
bacchanalia
club community beefsteaks?
John, you want to take that one?
There you go.
I'm not sure about
clam bakes.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the beefsteaks, but there's definitely some events.
Clam bakes sound more like Long Island. Than,
And let's quick cut. You poured a beer before. We're taking a short break. But what was the first beer? Was it some type of brown ale?
It is, yeah. So every class of students I work with has a research project, and they have to present different styles of beer to the class. All about the history of the style and what the flavor profile should be and all that. And then they vote on which one to brew as a class project for their graduation. So this is this semester's – they also get to name it. So this semester's class project is Brown Ale, which was the student name for the beer. A very traditional kind of
– Typical student name.
Yeah.
We get some good ones.
Dumb names are okay as long as they're funny. And this one was kind of funny, so I let them go with it. But yeah, this will be.
And then you put them on tap in the.
Yeah, this is on tap. This will be on tap in the egg, and probably at American Bounty, our farm table restaurant, and then it'll be on at the graduation, which is of course what the students are looking forward to. So they graduate pretty soon.
All the restaurants serve our beers on tap.
Yeah, we have all the restaurants have anywhere between 2 and 8 taps, depending on the restaurant.
So it's worth going up there. But over the holidays, you're closed Christmas time.
We close the 19th through the 3rd. So like a traditional college. We have summer break, and we have Christmas break, and we have a spring break. So anytime you're coming up, we have five restaurants, and we'd love to have you. But you should probably call just to make sure the schedule is think of it as a college restaurant. So
wow. We are off to a great start. Matt, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. The holidays are just around the corner, and at Beer Sessions Radio, we don't just care about what's in your glass. There's one smart kitchen appliance that can make the best Thanksgiving turkey you've ever tasted, for real. Joule Sous Vide uses precise temperature control and trademarked visual doneness guides to make perfect food every time. Cook incredible dishes at home via the Joule app on your phone or tablet. Or try voice-controlled cooking with the Joule Amazon Alexa skill. Hey Alexa, dial me up a brisket. There's zero guesswork, so steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, roasts, eggs, all come out exactly the way you like them. Just be sure to save room for pumpkin pie. Joule, perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/joule and enter our code HRN to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com joule and enter our code HRN. Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guys, it's that time of year, heritageradionetwork.org. We're looking for new members and support for the winter. But there's a great, great group of people here running this place. There's a studio in the back of Roberta's. There's an office. It takes a lot of people to keep this whole network going with over 30 shows, some about cheese, some chef shows, farm shows, and other food issue shows. But we're Beer Sessions Radio, and you guys can help us out. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and be a supporter for the winter, okay? All right, we got a great show here. We got Waldy Maloof, one of my favorite chefs. He's the head of all the food and beverage at Culinary Institute of America. And you wouldn't believe it, but they have a brewery that Brooklyn Brewery helped them start. And Hutch, our buddy who was at Crossroads Brewery, is the head brewer there too.
Yeah, I've been there for, we opened up a little over 3 years ago.
Yeah. I tease Hutch all the time, and he has the best brewmaster job in the state, if not the country.
Well, I mean, you know, for those of you that have worked, work in the industry or have worked in restaurants, mostly my friends are really upset with me that I have air conditioning, and we have a cleaning and maintenance crew. So when something breaks, a professional comes and fixes it, and you know, all I have to do is put in a work order. That's usually what gets people really upset.
I'm actually curious, like, how many applications did you get for that job?
We did actually get quite a few.
I think I'm the best of thousands, I think is what we're going to say.
Don't tell him too much. But yes, he did.
What
he
about
did
you, Jamie?
Come to the top.
I mean, have you been up to the brewery at CIA? Have you been up in the Hudson Valley for the beer scene up there at all?
I have not been to the CIA, although I look forward to going, especially now that that Hutch is here and Waldy, they're spearheading the entire project. I think it's great, and yes, I'm definitely going to make my way up there. In terms of the Hudson Valley, we do work with some producers up there. We're mostly on Long Island, and a lot of our grain that we get from
upstate. Let's give the backstory. So, yep. St. James Brewery on Long Island.
St. James Brewery.
And you're a New York farm brewer.
We're a New York farm brewery, and what that means is that we get the law states that we get some of our ingredients from farmers in New York State. We do 100% wherever we can. That's what we're all about. It's about promoting local farmers and promoting local agriculture, especially on Long Island. That's really our focus.
And then, and John, we met you several years ago. Tell us about your family farm, and you had the Kickstarter to get a hop harvester.
That's right. I think that's how we first met, Jimmy. That was 2013. My family's had the farm since my great-grandparents immigrated here. Originally, it was a potato farm, then slowly transitioned to vegetables. And like I had mentioned earlier, now we're specializing mainly in small berries, asparagus, and the hops is the newest thing, which we planted in 2010. One of the first farms in the state to do that. And shortly after planting them, I realized it was a heck of a job to pick them all. Years ago, 100 years ago, when hops were really popular in New York State, they would, you know, recruit people from the city to come out hop picking as a holiday and a festive activity. That doesn't work that well anymore. So I needed to raise money to get a specialized German hop harvesting machine. And decided to do a Kickstarter, and went to a few events in Beer Week, and that's how we met. And it's been going great ever since. You know, we're looking to expand the hop yard. The brewers that work with our hops are happy with the product, so it's been coming along really nicely.
I mean, that's been a big part of our show. We've seen the growth of New York malt facilities and hop farmers. I mean, Jamie, are you finding there's enough malt and hops coming out of New York for you now?
Yes, without a doubt. There's enough, not just in terms of quantity, but also in terms of quality. We can get all of the product that we need here in New York State, and we don't have to look any farther than that. Absolutely. And with working with great farmers like John Stanley and a couple of other family farms that we have on Long Island, it's worked out very well for us. Yeah.
But you're also, because you're way out on Long Island, it's hard to get to you, isn't it?
Well, that's, I guess.
I mean, do you have guys delivering, taking the ferry from Connecticut, or do they come all the way down through the city and drive out?
I was strategically thinking when I placed my brewery right in the middle of Long Island that we'd have access to our farmers, which are predominantly on the East End, as well as most of our customers in our markets, which tend to be more towards the West End of Long Island, New York City as well. So yeah, it's a perfect spot for us. Not too hard to get to the farmers. Not too hard to get to our major markets. It's great.
It's great to see you, man.
Yeah, it's always great to see you.
When you first started brewing that at my pub, Jimmy's Number 43, we were one of your first accounts in the city.
That's true.
So it's great to see you guys.
One of our first supporters, and we thank you for that, Jimmy.
Now, I have a question for you, Jamie, as a foreign brewery. I believe the requirement is going from 20% New York grown ingredients to 60% next year. Do you think that supply is still going to be there with the...
That's correct, Tony. In the coming up in 2019, the minimum that we can use of New York State product as per law is 60%, and I believe a few years, 6 years or so after that, it's going to go up to 90%. So this is just kind of the midpoint of the.
But you guys are hitting it. You're going to hit those numbers.
Yes, we do, and we do it basically. We try to by working backwards by noticing or taking notice of what the farmers are growing around us and working backwards in terms of what we want to produce and brew and sell really comes from our farmers. So what they have and what's fresh is what we want. So.
And for our listeners, next week's show, December 18th, we have Jason Saylor from Strong Rope with a couple other New York farmers and hop growers. We'll be talking specifically about New York sourcing. So Hutch, at CIA Brewery, are you buying any ingredients from local farms? I know that, like, what CIA has done is you guys have made a huge imprint. You go to that part of the Hudson Valley, there's so many great little restaurants run by CIA grads. There must be a lot of farms that supply your campus, you know. But you can talk about that in general, but also in terms of the beer.
Yeah, we do. You know, we're not a farm brewery, so we don't buy, you know, we're not looking for, we don't necessarily have to get a number percentage. But we do support and use Hudson Valley malt. Up in Germantown, Dennis does some great floor malted, traditional pale malts and pilsners and stuff up there. A little bit of hops from the Finger Lakes, but I'm actually really curious to learn more about your hops out in Long Island because I'm always looking for interesting New York hops. You know, one of the challenges, and I think you guys could probably talk to this, it's not that we don't have the amount of ingredients in New York or that we don't have the quality, but the varieties can be somewhat limited because especially these days with the current trends in IPAs and what people really are buying a lot of, these big particular tropical fruit flavors and hops, those are all proprietary brands that are plants that we can't buy and grow here in New York. So what we really need is to promote and grow a New York variety hop that is unique to New York. But yeah, we do support the local maltster as much as we can. And then when we're looking for non-traditional ingredients, yeah, we're absolutely going to be bringing in local stuff. We have a brew coming up this week, actually a collaboration with Toast USA. Which is a brewery that uses leftover bread as their from Bread Alone. Yeah. So we're actually harvesting. We're getting leftover harvesting. We're saving leftover bread from Apple Pie Bakery, our cafe, as well as from our high volume kitchen here that's in the Egg, and we're brewing a beer that's about 25% wasted bread, basically. But we also use a lot of local Hudson Valley purveyors when it comes to fruits or spices or herbs or anything else that we can use. And actually, we have a lot of stuff growing on the campus, and so we've been working on using that in beer. We have, you know, on the roof of the Egg where the brewery is, we have strawberry plants. And I said, hey, look, anything that doesn't look good, I can use it.
The students are growing.
Yeah, and they're harvesting it.
Students are growing and harvesting, and that is growing and more you start. Next year, our farm-to-table program, which is a bachelor's degree concentration, is moving from California back to here. And we're actually going to be resurrecting FDR's Victory Garden. FDR's home is right next to the school and his presidential museum. And the Victory Garden there is it's been languishing for a while. So now we're joining the federal park system. And we're going. Our class is going to resurrect that. We'll be using that produce in the school. The school has relationships with over 75 different farms in the Hudson Valley, and we spend anywhere from $1 million to $1.3 million on local products every year.
Do you have anything in foraging in the curriculum yet? Because that seems to be something I hear about. More
Johnny,
and more.
Too. Come on, everybody. This is a good one.
It's become a big deal, and we have one chef in particular. One of the chefs at the American Bounty Restaurant he's passionate about it, and he's been doing things and bringing things in and taking his students out foraging, and we don't, we can't really cook a lot. We cook with it and for ourselves, but we don't, can't really sell it because it's not, it's foraged, so you have to be a little bit careful. Sure. So, but we do foraging, and experiment.
So if I have a friend, he's a chef, and he goes upstate and he gets some of those spring, those spring onions that
the,
love.
Ramps.
Yeah. Is that something you can actually sell in your restaurant or not?
Technically, no.
We'll call it a gray area. I think.
Yeah, it's a gray area. It's a gray area. Technically, not.
But like the chef he's talking about, Chef Kaywerk, who's one of our chefs in American Bounty, our farm table restaurant, is really passionate about foraging and using the things that are growing even on campus, which we really do pay attention to what's growing there. So he actually brought me a bunch of hemlock branches and hemlock to kind of experiment with. It wasn't a product that I ended up taking to full scale, but it was really cool. And by the way, hemlock, the evergreen is not hemlock, the poisonous plant, which when he first said hemlock, I had to go punch it. I'm like, didn't Socrates kill himself with that? but no, it's a great evergreen quality. So I actually experimented with that in an IPA to see if we could, use that, because there's a bunch of it growing on campus. It wasn't something that ended up coming to fruition this past year, but maybe next year might be a possibility.
And Johnny, when Tony asked about foraging, you kind of lit up. And then you said ramps before anybody else.
Yeah, I just had that in my mind because I think that's a discipline that's certainly becoming more and more popular. A lot of my friends out on the East End who are chefs, we work with a lot of chefs that are our customers on the farm. And it's definitely, hear little bits here and there about what they're doing, and it's interesting stuff. It's growing outside. It's natural. I can understand the reservations of it, with certain food safety regulations. But I think it's a good thing, and it's exciting.
The flavors are unique, and it's different when you're foraging wild plants, and the flavors are just that much more different than anything you're used to, and it's really a lot of fun and great to eat.
Let's take a step back. We're drinking a St. James Brewery beer. What was that, Jamie?
The first beer that we had, Jimmy, was called a Myrtille. It's our blueberry ale, and it's done with blueberries that are grown and harvested, right? And,
so St. James Brewery Myrtille?
St. James Brewery Myrtille is the name of the beer, and it's a blueberry ale. Myrtille is the French word for blueberry. Yeah. Try and keep it pretty basic. But
And yours is doing what, kind of a Belgian-inspired farmhouse?
All of our beers come from our house yeast strain, which is derived from a Belgian strain. Mm-hmm, absolutely. However, Jimmy, it's a topic for another show. We've come across a yeast strain from an English shipwreck that went down right here off the coast of Long Island, about 21 miles. It was a Cunard luxury liner. And we were able to harvest the yeast and repropagate that, and we're going to start brewing from that. But that's
how did you harvest
yeast? James
is
a diver. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah, we do a lot of deep sea scuba diving here on Long Island.
And you just swabbed it right off of something inside the ship?
Yeah, we did. We pulled the bottles out from the hull of the ship about 20 feet down of the seafloor.
So you harvested from bottles that were in the ship?
That's correct.
Okay.
The, we were lucky enough because the bottles happened to be upside down in packed in mud. So we were lucky enough.
Incredibly cool. How did you know about this? Did someone say, there's some bottles of beer, let's call Jamie?
Yes, not just bottles of beer, bottles of wine, bottles of you name it. It was the first class holding area for the first class dining room. Just like every other shipwreck, there's certain areas of the ship that will open up. Every winter, a storm will come. It'll knock a whole plate over, and this is exactly what happened.
Let's go back in time because we're talking beefsteak. So this Cunard liner, what beers were on that luxury liner?
Well, that's a good question, and that's where we're at right now, trying to figure out where this actually came from. You've got your Guinness, you've got your Bass, Allsops, Tony. Allsops.
Allsops, you got me there. But what era exactly are we talking about here?
1880s.
1880s. Okay. Yeah. So definitely.
So also, so that's actually the beefsteaks were going pretty strong then. Women didn't have the right to vote then, so you had a little more lively male gatherings.
I'm sure they were more lively, but they became a little bit more sophisticated, I guess, when women started coming, and probably became better. And
but let's say it's 1880s. What would have been some of the beers? Probably know the styles, you said Kolsch or a lighter lager.
That would have been available here?
What beers would have been available for beefsteaks in New York back then?
That's a great question for a beer historian. I would think that most of the ales made in this part of the world at that time were of English base, probably low hopped. I would think on the sweeter side. I mean, there's a ton of history from New York City up through Poughkeepsie and Albany in the ales that were made at that time. I mean, this was the brewing center of the United States, it's particularly Poughkeepsie and Albany, where there's a lot of beer coming out of this part of the world. Amazing to see these old breweries that were putting out, you know, 25,000-30,000 barrels.
Exactly. Right here in Bushwick, right, was a brewing capital. But I can also reference Ballantyne in Newark that became famous for their IPA. That was quite hefty.
And we know Rheingold was a big New York brewery. But other, you know, what would they have served at the beefsteaks back then? I know that in the Hudson Valley, there was the Vassar College people know, but the precursor to Vassar College was Vassar Brewing.
Does
anybody know that?
Yeah, the brother of Matthew Vassar. So
German styles, right, were really...
Yeah, it was... the family came across and made a success of themselves. The grandsons were the Vassars, one of whom started Vassar Hospital, the other whom left his bequest to become Vassar College. But yeah, they were the brewers, and it's still a lot of the money came from beer that went into the college and went into the hospital.
Jimmy, I'd like also to just take it back a step from when we were talking about the CIA and how you were growing stuff at the CIA and using it. And I just want to talk to what Hutch had said about how strawberries, for example, if you can't use them, we can. And how important that is just in terms of us being a farm brewery. It's not so much where you get your ingredients from. It's also what you do with them and where they end up as well. You know, it's a big part of it. And I think that's a great thing that the CIA can add to their overall curriculum, not just for the food itself, but in order how to sustainably grow. And
did you make a beer with the blueberries also?
We did. We used the blueberries that were grown at Kinsella Farms right here. And
let's pour that.
Sure.
So just say the name of that beer. So it's St. James Brewery, and what beer is it?
So this beer here is called Myrtille, and it's our blueberry ale. The blueberries come from Kinsella Farms in Wading River, and it's a Belgian-style ale. And what's nice about this beer is when you use real fruit, the skins impart a lot of color and some flavor. So you get a nice pink hue from the blueberry skins themselves, much in the same way as red grape.
So being on Long Island, you're really taking advantage of the local products, which in your case is often fruit.
That's correct. And every year is different. And that's the best part of it, is we can't really replicate year from year what is going to be available. We could get late frost, you know, so it's really great to work with the farmers that way.
That's cool, man. Wow. We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in a few minutes and finish up here on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, it's almost Christmas. We've got a really cool show. We're talking about Culinary Institute of America, breweries, farm breweries on Long Island, Hudson Valley. It's cool. But quick shout out one more time, heritageradionetwork.org. That's our network. That's behind us. There's over 30 shows about cheese and chefs and farms. And of course, we're Beer Sessions Radio. But it's that time of year, end of year giving, fundraising, membership drive, heritageradionetwork.org. All right, check it out. So, guys, Jamie, you just poured us. So, you're on Long Island. You're working with a lot of local farms, including John Conzeller, who's our buddy. But you made a beer with blueberries.
We make a beer with blueberries. We start the season with strawberries, but the blueberry beer this year was a particularly nice one. We had a nice crop of blueberries this year, so that's really what we look forward to every year, is doing what we call our harvest series. Starts with strawberries because they're the first, where we are, that's the first fruit that's usually harvested, and it ends with apples. But in between, we also have our blueberry beer and a few others.
What I like about these beers, Jamie, and Hutch is going to tell me some of the techniques behind it, these aren't fruit wines. I mean, this is a beer. This tastes like a beer to me. So how do you use fruit in a way that doesn't turn it into a fruit wine?
That's correct, and that's a good statement. We like to accentuate the fruit, but all at the same time, we make beer. That's what we do. So everything is done on a beer base, and then the fruit is there to become the star of the show. But at heart, we are a brewery, and so everything is barley-based, and we like to keep it that way. But the fruits are the star of the show.
I mean, anything, it's all about balance, right? You're looking to highlight the flavor of this particular ingredient, in this case, blueberry or strawberry or fruit. But when you think about when you eat blueberries or you eat strawberries, they're not particularly sweet, you know? They can have a lot of tartness and bite to them. When you have a sugary, sweet blueberry product, you know, beer, it's not real blueberries. It's some sort of sugary extract. So really what you're doing when you're showing off a beer like this, you've got the balance of that nice malted barley base. You've got the nice kind of mildly tart blueberries, the great pink color. Like it's a nicely balanced product. It's not over the top. It doesn't
taste you making
fake.
any beers at CIA with fruit?
We do some. We brought a Weiss beer that I did with Garrett Oliver. It came up and collaborated with me. So sort of a sour beer, but a very mild sour with lemon zest. We've done a bunch of different things. Actually, in collab, we're talking about a beer that I shouldn't talk about yet that involves an American fruit that most people don't use. We do some stuff. Fruit is one of those.
Poison hemlock?
It's not poison. No. It's not a poison
foraged,
fruit.
Illegal.
It's actually, we're talking about doing a beer with pawpaw. I'm not familiar with pawpaw.
I can't believe you just told me.
Yeah, whatever.
Pawpaw is going to get really expensive.
It is already really expensive, so that will not that won't be the problem. But yeah. You know, it's all about using an interesting ingredient, showing it off in an interesting way, but in a way that is balanced, right? You still have to sell this to customers. They still have to enjoy drinking the beer.
I mean, I think this speaks to the evolution or the sophistication, really, of brewing, craft brewing, is that you have a beer like this where the fruit flavor is there, but it's the first wave of these fruit beers that we had in the 1990s, end of the 1990s. They were very sweet, like Hutch was just talking about, and now it's like the nuance, you know, the fruit flavor is there, but it's beer. As you
know, this is great. Cheers, Jamie. Good job. So, Waldy, going way back, I'm trying to, you know, you're one of my heroes, and I know you know Michael Colomeco, who had a show on this network for a while. Many years ago, I know you made a collaboration beer. When were you at? When you were at with Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn Brewery?
At the Hudson River Club. We did some collaboration.
And what did you put in it? You had some interesting spices.
It was for a game dinner, and we made it with black peppercorns and juniper berries, if I'm not mistaken. Although I couldn't get Garrett to remember that, but I'm pretty sure that's what it was because to go with the venison and the peppercorn sauce and the ginger sauce. I mean the juniper berries.
So was that more of a chef's idea of what the beer should taste like, or was that Garrett's idea of what he wanted to pair with it?
I think it was probably the two of us drinking a beer and talking about the game dinner, and it came out. It just came about.
That's how the best collaborations happen, right? Let's have a beer and come up with something fun.
And it was excellent. And we did a few others. I did a couple. We did, at the Hudson River Club. We did a couple beer dinners. We did at the Rainbow Room. We did a couple beer dinners with Garrett and Brooklyn, and we would always try to do something like that when we were matching the foods with the beers.
You know, and also going back, I mean, Garrett's book, The Brewmaster's Table, is still, to me, one of the classics of food and beer in America. Did you work with him in any capacity of that, or give him any recipes for that?
I'm in it, and we worked a little bit on... he talked about the Hudson River Club. He talked about us collaborating on some beers and doing, and he and I matching foods to beers and actually doing beer dinners instead of wine dinners. And he did it with a few of my friends with Charlie Palmer at the River Cafe, with at the Union Square. He did it with a few of us, and it really really came about.
No,
and
it's
made it what it is today.
It's huge. You guys really made a big difference going back. So way back then, you were a student at Culinary Institute of America. You know, in terms of like the training that you went through then, and now 30 years later, you're running some of the programs. I mean, how has the school changed since you were a student?
Well, it's huge. compared to when I went. And there was 100 students on one campus when I went. Now we have 2,200 students at this campus and 250 in California and 150 in Texas and 100 in Singapore. So it's and all our programs, we do a lot of programs with Harvard, with the Army, with Navy, with different organizations. Our Menus of Change program is working with the National Restaurant Association. So we are a major part of the food and beverage industry in this country, and I like to say that the Culinary Institute of America has actually was part of the food and beverage movement that happened from the 1970s until now, and what I've been able to watch happen and be part of for the last 40 years.
And how do you see, now that you have the brewery at CIA, how do you see the role of that growing or changing or influencing the industry?
Well, what the school is becoming is a university, a full-fledged university based on hospitality, science, the way that food affects the world, the way that the food industry affects the world. It's the largest industry in the world, and employs the most people, and obviously keeps us all.
You know,
I've never
heard anyone say that, but I believe you.
It is.
We believe Wally. Yes.
And the effects of what food and eating out and the effects of water and climate change and we're all part of that, and the school is being a major part of that, and as it becomes that university and involved in research and medicine and food science, and that's really where it's going.
A lot of that's driven by our students as well.
Yes.
I mean, you've got, you know, this is what we were talking before about, you know, sustainability and reusing making sure that everything is being used properly. You know, a lot of that is coming from our students. You know, we've all lived through sort of the second or third iteration of the craft beer boom, where people are more passionate about craft beer in a local capacity, and that's a bigger part of a whole movement of people wanting artisanal local products, right? But now we're seeing it from students coming up that are 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. This is not a new thing for them. This is the way that they've grown up, and they want to take this to the next level. You know, we've got students who are the ones who are leading and facilitating these sort of movements. We've got students, you know, when I say, you know, kind of as a throwaway line, oh, you know, we want to reuse the strawberries that aren't being sold from the roof. Well, that's coming from a student. You know, when I talk about, I want to reuse the bread that is coming from our bake shops that, you know, can't be sold anymore, that is being facilitated and led by a student who's coming to me and saying, I want to do this. Like, how do we make this happen?
Or why aren't we doing
it? Right. And that's now growing into programs. So now it's not just one kid, it's one young adult. It's whole programs as we grow into a university of, you know, how does food fit into our world, right? It's not just about a restaurant. It's not just about a chef. It's about, you know, we all touch food and drink on a daily basis. So how does the school grow this, and how do our students lead us into that part of the world?
Wow. And just let me ask John, because John's how many generations is your family farm on Long Island?
Fourth. I'm the fourth. Yeah.
So these larger world issues, climate change, sustainability, use of ingredients, how do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative. You know, I think there's not a farmer out there who will tell you that climate change is not happening. We see it every year. You know, we were just talking about all the rain we had this past year is an abnormally high amount. And those are things that we need to, you know, plan for and try to understand about how we can still do what we do in an ever-changing climate, you know. So it's definitely an issue that's out there and people more and more are talking about.
Jamie, anything about that?
Well, what I was most impressed with when I went to John's farm was how he worked in the insecticides or natural insecticides and herbicides that they were using, what they had available in lieu of bad pesticides, and how they could work that in. And to me, that was a really amazing part of the new farm movement.
And hold on, we just want to give a quick plug. So Justin Kennedy, our producer, is here in the studio. He also produces our rivals at Steal This Beer.
Oh, we're not a rival.
Crazy
Jimmy,
Augie Carton Brewery, and Mr. John Hall is another one of those great American beer editors and writers. So what's going on? You guys are up in Boston this weekend for an IPA festival.
Yeah, we're going to be in Boston on Friday, this Friday, December 14th, for a live show with, it's at Sam Adams Brewery, the tasting room there, with Sam Calgione from Dogfish Head. And, yeah, I just want to give a shout-out to that. And
what does Steal the Spirit do? You've got guests come on with, what, two beers and a blind glass?
Yeah, so it's very different than this show. We have one guest per show. It's me and Augie and John, and we talk about... Augie talks a lot. John talks a lot. The guest gets to talk a little bit. I pour the beer. And we do a blind tasting. Yeah, Tony was on recently. He can tell you all about what happens on that show. And Jimmy,
another time.
Gone, of course, yeah.
But, what is nice is it's at Barcade in Jersey City, and they do have an open tab at the bar, so I took advantage.
We're now at Treadwell Park in downtown in Manhattan, so we switched from Barcade.
But you're going to be in Boston.
We'll be
Sam
in Boston.
Adams
yeah,
Brewery.
Tickets are available on our website, stillthisbeer.com.
Okay, so if you're listening live, you'll hear this. If you're listening on podcasts,
you might miss it. Yeah.
But thank you, Justin. Yeah. And it's great to see you. So, guys,
you too,
this has
Jimmy.
Been a really cool show. One more time, I just want Waldy and Hotch just give us a quick wrap up. Anything else you want to say? The beefsteak's coming up.
The beefsteak coming. Go online, go to CIA Restaurant Group, and go online, buy tickets. Come on up. It's an hour and a half on
February 2nd.
February 2nd, Saturday, February 2nd, the day before Super Bowl, the night before Super Bowl.
So, six courses of beef?
Six courses of beef lamb.
Oyster.
Shrimp.
So you got the oysters in there, Tony.
We got oysters.
Get the lamb. The lamb is where it's at.
And it ends right at the end. We put a bottle of Taconic bourbon on the table and a bunch of empty glasses and some ice cubes. And that's how the evening ends.
Don't give me napkins and don't give me any forks.
No napkins, no silverware.
People come up all the time. I don't think people know how close Hyde Park is to the city. It's a really easy ride up the Metro North. Come see us. Go to the restaurants. Come see the brewery. You can get tickets to the beefsteak at AmericanBountyRestaurant.com. If you go to our
their CIA Restaurant Group.
Yeah. If you go to our the Instagram page for the brewery, CIA Brewery, I posted the link in our bio.
I'm so glad you guys came out. It was a great focus of the show. I know your PR team with Gita was trying really hard to schedule this, and we did it. And we also got in John and Jamie. You guys just give another quick shout out.
Always a pleasure to see you, Jimmy.
St. James Brewery, Long Island.
Yep, Long Island, New York. Thank you.
John Kinsella, Kinsella Farms. Thanks for having us.
And John,
were you guys
the first farm in New York to grow hops recently?
One of the first. One of the first on Long Island. Not quite sure about upstate, but pretty early on, yeah.
Yeah, well, we're still rooting for you guys. And
appreciate that.
From Ale Street News.
Ale Street News, 27 years. Keep following us online. And fun fact about the CIA, the TAP New York Festival actually originated the first 2 years at the CIA.
It did.
Wow, that's cool. Well, hey, everyone, thanks for putting the show together. Justin Kennedy, our producer, Matt Patterson, engineer, Dylan Hoyer, our intern. Thanks for joining us here on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm Jimmy Carbone. We'll see you next week on Beer Sessions Radio, talking about sourcing New York ingredients. All right. Woo!
Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio, for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.